see, and I guess let's get right to your working history. After the Navy, you came back here to Bridgeport?
Yes, I did.
And what was your first full-time job?
I got out of the Navy in September 1959, and I went to work. I got a job as a machine trainee at the Avco Corporation in Stratford in November of that year, 1959. And I've worked there since then, almost 40 years.
Almost 40 years. Describe your first job. What exactly did you do?
At Avco?
Yes.
Okay. I had never run any kind of industrial machines. When I was in the Navy, I was a communications technician. Before I went into the Navy, I had worked in Bridgeport at the Hotel Barnum in Bridgeport for about 2 years as a bellhop. Mm-hmm. So I had no factory type of skills, and the state of Connecticut, in conjunction with Avco Corporation, was running a machine training program, and I went through this machine training program, on the job training in combination with some classroom, for about 90 days on a vertical shortwave, and I worked at that profession for 25 years.
Okay. And what exactly does a vertical turret lathe do?
Well, the company itself manufactured a variety of gas turbine engines for military helicopters primarily. We also made components for various missiles, Minuteman missiles, Polaris missiles. We made heat shields and Avco coating for all the space vehicles. That were the coating. The vehicles were all coated, so they wouldn't burn up when they when they reentered the atmosphere. And it was a long. They had a huge machine shop and a vertical shortwave is primarily a machine that you would put a part on a machine, a casting, and you would cut it to certain specifications and dimensions, and it would go down to the next operation.
Okay. So that was your position for about 25 years there?
Yes, with the company, and I eventually became an inspector. I would inspect the parts.
Okay, do you have a union there?
Oh, yes, the United Auto Workers Union, Local 1010.
And they were there from when you started?
They were there when I was hired. They were organized when the plant was opened in 1951. The plant was opened by Victor Emmanuel, who was an entrepreneur. During the Korean War, the plant had been there since the 1920s. It was originally a Sikorsky facility. In 1943, Sikorsky moved to Sikorsky was part of the United Aircraft Corporation. Sikorsky moved to helicopter production to Bridgeport, and Chance Watt was the a division of the United Aircraft Corporation, and they made Corsair aircraft for World War II, Navy fighters. And that plant was closed in 1948. In 1951, the plant was reopened by Victor Emmanuel, Avco Corporation, and the union organized the workforce, the air production workforce, and I became a member of the union 60 days after I was hired.
So it was a union shop?
It was a union shop, yes.
Do you recall any Well, I guess first off, you describe some of your coworkers. What was like the racial or ethnic makeup?
Well, it was and the machine.
Plants as a whole.
In the factory, it was mostly white male, predominantly white male. Very few women were in the factory. Mm-hmm. Not very many minorities at all. It was mostly, as I say, male, white males. It wasn't until sometime, probably in the during the Vietnam War, that women were, because of the shortage of manpower, the plant was very busy at the time. Matter of fact, they had about 12,000 employees working three shifts, 7 days a week, around the clock. And I was a steward at the time, and women started to come into the plant, certain entry-level jobs, the least skilled jobs, light work, machining jobs. And they had the seniority. The union started pressing for opportunities to get them promoted. So eventually that kind of sex barrier in the machine shop was broken down. But it didn't occur until the middle 1970s.
I see. And you say at that time, during the Vietnam War, there were about 12,000 people there?
Yes.
When you first started there, about how many people worked there?
When I came to work in 1959, AVCO had, you know, looking at the total workforce, probably about 6,500 employees, that I recall. There had been major layoffs, in, from what I understood, in 1957-58, after the Korean War. And John Kennedy was elected in 1960, and shortly thereafter, AVCO started getting busy. They were making the products that Kennedy started spending money in the defense for helicopters. He believed in counterinsurgency warfare, and they used the helicopters in Vietnam, the Huey Cobras, and the Bell helicopters. We made all the engines. So we made about 350 engines a month, which was a huge output of engines. And the engines would come back from, during the Vietnam War sometimes, they would bolt holes in them and everything for overhaul and repair. There was a slight layoff in the early 1963. By 1964, however, with the beginning of the escalation of the war in Vietnam, AVCO started to hire again and got very busy. And its peak was in 1969. There were about 12,000 employees.
You said three shifts?
Three shifts, yes. On the third shift, I was a steward and a committee man on the third shift, and we had about 1,000 employees just on the third shift. It was quite a place, humming and very busy place.
Yeah, I can remember. I was a teenager back around then. I can remember that there was always stuff happening over there.
Yeah, like wildcat strikes and things like that.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
On the whole, we'll get to that right now. What was the treatment like by the bosses there? I mean,
well, the relationship, labor management relationship, was a very rocky relationship for many years. AVCO Corporation, when I first came there, AVCO Corporation was probably, in relation to other aerospace companies nationally, the wages were somewhat lower, considerably lower, did not have the kind of benefits that were typical in aerospace. And our international union, based in Detroit, representing a lot of the aerospace companies around the country, they did a lot of research. And so there was a very intense, very militant, confrontational type of a relationship for many years. And it was characterized by numerous wildcat strikes, rank and file strikes, particularly on the night shift, the third shift.
Tell us in some detail about that.
These strikes were, a matter of fact, I think we hold the record. We held the record for wildcat strikes in any local union in the country. They used to point to a factory out in Ohio where they had a militant rank and file, but ours, in its own quiet way, was, I think we had over 100 wildcat strikes. And the problem with that, it was an anarchy, industrial anarchy. There was no functioning grievance procedure. Workers felt they had, out of frustration, the only way they can get a problem resolved was through taking this direct action. And eventually, the company in 1966 was able to get a permanent restraining order, an injunction against the local union and a lot of the individual officers and members, permanently restraining us from engaging in wildcat strikes, which were illegal under our contract. But that itself was a bit of, I think, legal precedent. I don't think there's anybody.
But what were were these bread and butter money issues?
Absolutely, most of the time. I can remember specifically the type of issues. The company would do different classifications. It was in the plant at that time. You had in the factory perhaps 400 or 500 separate job classifications, and there was this finite fragmentation of jobs. And it seemed there was only a couple of them were at the higher labor grades, and the bulk of them were in the mid to lower labor grades. So what the company would do In particular, an example, the wage classification had A, B, and C. The A would be in the highest labor grade, and there were labor grade 4, B would be in labor grade 6, and the C would be in labor grade 8. So what the company would do would, they would declare a layoff in a department, and they lay the A operators off, and the A operators would go down to the personnel department, and they say, well, you can bump, and we have some openings here in this department as a B, two labor grades lower. The employees would come back to the same department right after lunch, doing the same job, the same work, two labor grades lower. And it was that type of stuff, and it was, that caused a lot of the wildcat strikes. The local union itself was, I'd say, a very politically active local union. Local union politics, there were different large factions and caucuses, and that was a factor as well in some of the, that led to some of the wildcat strikes. I mean, the union was not actually blameless, the wildcat strikes finally came to an end, I would say, in 1967, 68. We had a new elected administration running the local union, and it seemed that the rank and file, at that time we had about 5,000 members, pretty much were tired of the anarchy in the local union, and they felt the real enemy was the company, and the union had to get together, and it was in their best interest to support a good, solid local union administration.
If you could just, again, on the wildcat strikes, the mechanics of it, how would it work, let's say, in a typical shift? Or you would just pull the whole shift off?
Sometimes that was the case. Sometimes they were just spontaneous. A small group of employees would walk out, perhaps on the second shift, around lunchtime, for whatever the issue was. And maybe it was they felt somebody was disciplined unjustly, the company tried to fire one of the shop stewards or something like that. And as I said, I was a third shift committee man. My shift started at 11 o'clock. So I would usually get a call around 10 o'clock by somebody on the second shift, and they'd tell me, well, Dave, there's a wildcat going on at the plant, and we appreciate your support. And I'd try to find out what it was all about. So I would get there a little early before the shift starting time, and the people that I represented would come to me, and my stewards would say, well, what's going on? What should we do? And I said, well, just go on home. Don't cross the picket line. That was a very strong tradition, not crossing a picket line, even on a wildcat strike. So usually the third shift always took the brunt of these wildcats. We would lose the whole shift. And sometimes they would just last a shift. Sometimes they went a little longer. It would last 3 or 4 days. And many times we would end up with a long laundry list of 50 or 60 or 100 issues. And all the frustrations sort of boil over, and that was an opportunity. Everybody came forward and put their issues on the list. Okay, take care of these.
And would that force management to sit down and bargain with you, generally?
Yes, management what contributed to the problem was a very political management style. They had a lot of cronies and different factions within management, for instance, the manufacturing management would be rivaling the quality control management, and the night shift would be, so they would be competing with the day shift within management, within the various management structures. And they were very good at playing off and manipulating the bargaining unit people as pawns in this kind of rivalry. And the labor relations department was at war with everybody. And it was always a game of kind of one-upsmanship. So I think if a supervisor or a superintendent would resolve a grievance and that was favorable to the union, well, his rivals or somebody would attack him. So it was always this, we had this very intense environment within management, which I believe contributed to a very large extent to the anarchy in the plant, and until they got a different management group, and that was more responsible, that was willing to take a position and stick with it and be able to enforce it plant-wide, And that's when the Wildcat started.
And this was primarily in the, let's say, first half of the 60s?
The mid-60s. We did have probably the highlight of the confrontations that the union had with the company was in 1967. We had the last Taft-Hartley injunction in the country. It was at the height of the Vietnam War. The local union had been in bargaining and for a new contract. The contract was due to expire in April, middle of April, April 15th. And the President Johnson signed a fact-finding, a Taft-Hartley Act. He was down in Puente del Este in Argentina or somewhere in South America at a Alliance for Democracy. Alliance for Progress conference. And he signed the Taft-Hartley injunction, putting the local restraining order, putting us back to work after about 4 days. And they, so the bargaining then was transferred down to Washington, D.C. It was very intense, high-level government involvement for the next 3 or 4 months. The contract was finally signed, finally resolved, almost at the brink of the expiration of the so-called 80-day cooling off period. It came down maybe about 3 days before that. Congress was poised to legislate new no-strike legislation to force the local back to work. And it was basically, the issues were basically, as I say, a catch-up contract. The union felt we're far behind most other aerospace companies in the country. A lot of other companies in the community were way behind. We were way behind them in terms of wages and benefits and things like that. And this is the best opportunity we're going to have to rectify it. And
what did the average? There were many labor grades, but what did the average entry-level employee, let's say?
Well,
make there, let's say 1966, 67.
Matter of fact, just today I was looking at in the plant a ad that was in the Connecticut Post for mostly different types of machine operators, and the hiring rates were somewhere around between $2.50 an hour and $3.13 an hour. But at that time, that was a very good rate. As a matter of fact, Avco Corporation, the reason they published the rates was because they were at the top of the spectrum in the Southern Connecticut community for that particular type of work. We did have one other very interesting contract strike in 1964. 1964 was a short strike, but it was very intense. The union decided to mass picket the plant. It surrounded the plant with as many as over 1,000 pickets, 2,000 pickets, and kept the whole plant shut down for about 10 days. We had a couple hundred pickets were arrested. The Stratford police would take them down, pull them out at random out of the picket lines at the plant, take them down to the police station on Main Street in Stratford. We had a bail person down there, bail them out. And we had a shuttle service set up and bring them right back to the picket line and start all over again. One guy got arrested like that 3 times in one day.
Now, where was the, these were primarily Wildcat strikes, where was the international?
No, the international was horror-stricken. They were a problem child of the International Union. They always immediately disavowed the local union and sent telegrams ordering us to go back to work, and they went on the air on the radio locally and with announcements that the strike was unauthorized. Of course, we all knew it was.
Yeah.
And we had problems for many years with our international union. And in the aerospace industry, particularly here in Connecticut, the United Auto Workers, the main focus was in the auto industry, and we always felt that the aerospace industry plants were sort of the stepchildren.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we decided to take things and matters into our own hands.
Okay. Now, you were obviously very active in the union. You know,
yes,
you're just
I
saying.
Was.
Did you experience any personal discrimination? Or harassment?
Oh, yes, many times. I can tell you the company, many people in the company, representatives, had a very strong, justifiably dislike for me because I was a militant and I wrote a lot of grievances and tried to enforce the contract. And I was involved with instigating and organizing many of the Wildcat strikes. And several of them, I was a issue, and it was the reinstatement of Stuart Kelly, who had been terminated for something or other, perhaps the night before. And my constituents, and I had a very good support, very good rapport with the people that I represented, decided to, they weren't going to let me hang out there, so they threw up a picket line. Yeah, so I had, over the years, I was terminated very short term, a day or two, with the company that tried to get rid of me, a few others, for one thing or another.
And because of the solidarity of the your fellow workers, yes, basically, yes, yeah, they throw up a picket line. And
that's it. And the, of course, you know, the product was absolutely necessary. It was, we were the sole source producer of the engines. And the company would always try to hide behind, wave the flag, and say, well, you know, they're very unpatriotic. But the majority of our workers, there, many of them, were themselves veterans, ex-servicemen. You know, we resented that. Don't wave the flag at us. You know, we've served our country, and we're not on strike against the military. We're on strike against Avco Corporation. And they were making extremely high profits throughout this entire period. We just wanted a little redistribution of the goods. That's all.
Sounds right. Mm-hmm. No, I'm supposed to be unbiased here. Okay. So, obviously now, AFCO. Well, it's not even AFCO anymore. Doesn't employ anywhere near the number of people. What happened after the Vietnam War?
Well, there was the plant went down. As I say, and I'll talk about the total plant. That's union and non-union. Yeah. From about 12,000 employees in 1969, early 1970, to about a little less than 3,000 by 1972. So mass layoffs. As a steward, at this time I was on the day shift because they eliminated pretty much of the most of the third shift. So I came on the day shift and I became a steward. And as a steward, we would go every week, we would get layoff sheets of 200 or 300 employees every week, and it was just a very, very difficult time. There were people with 25 years service. They were hired in 1951 and 1976, and these were toolmakers. These were skilled, very highly skilled people that were being laid off. And the best they could do, perhaps, was bump down to a job of a sweeper. And so there were no other jobs in Southern Connecticut. By then, many of the large factories, such as General Electric and all the employers, had closed and moved out of Bridgeport, so there weren't that many
jobs.
Yeah,
it's not like they could just move to another factory or something.
Right. For many years, up until the end of the Vietnam War, when there were layoffs, people would get laid off, employees would get laid off in at AFCO, and the next week they could go to Boards, they could go to Carpenter Steel, they could go to General Electric. There were Bastics, there were just dozens and scores of employers where people would get, with factory skills, could get work. But by then, there was really nothing left in the Southern Connecticut area and eventually throughout most of the state, except for Sikorsky and Pratt & Whitney.